BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
My name is Ross Sutherland. The blurb about this series, it describes this program as follows. Ross Sutherland explores the life of the boxer poet Arthur Craven and tries to uncover the mystery surrounding his final disappearance. Actually, that is almost exactly how the BBC pitched it to me as well. And at the time, I thought that sounded great. Although, I wish before committing, I'd paid more attention to just how many projects about Arthur Craven have failed in the past. It turns out there's at least 3 abandoned books. There was an unfinished film by Gerard Lebovici. There was even another 10-part BBC radio series from a couple of years ago, which ran aground in mid-production. Somewhere in the middle of every single one of these projects, whatever their plan had been to capture Arthur Craven, they reached a point where it all fell apart.
Yeah! Man of fashion, chemist, whore, drunk, musician,
this
laborer, painter,
actor. This is the escape artist.
Arthur Craven!
Arthur Craven.
The escape artist.
Monsieur Delaunay has a face like an inflamed pig.
Patron saint of the surrealists.
His colours have German accents.
Inventor of performance art.
Oh, asshole!
Fire the starting pistol for modernism.
To understand Dada, to even understand punk rock.
Yes! Arthur Craven!
Alternative comedy.
A little pose in front of the mirror.
Our most daring performers to date.
I write to anger my colleagues.
Cause a scandal in everything that he did.
You should have a look at Arthur Craven.
What a cunt!
Escape artist.
Yeah, I think the problem was we never really got a grip on who Arthur Craven really was.
Rachel Hattles was the producer of the BBC's first attempt at an Arthur Craven series.
The problem is Arthur Craven was always performing. He's always playing this exaggerated, brutish character. Yeah. It's like whenever he's in public, he's got this mask on. So, you know, you can never really trust anything he says. Plus, he's always spreading false stories about himself, like claiming he got thrown out of boarding school for putting the headmaster over his knee and caning him. Or claiming that he robbed a jeweller's in Switzerland.
Is that story not true?
If it was true, he'd be pretty stupid to bang on about it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Which is exactly what he did. That is part of what is so hard about Arthur Craven, and that made him very hard to approach journalistically. We couldn't really move beyond the myth.
Was it a relief when you decided to abandon the series?
Yes.
Craven is always presenting a persona. Hard to make a programme about, say, Bela Lugosi, when all you have access to is Dracula. Particularly if Bela Lugosi is pretending to be Dracula all the time, like even when he pops to the shops. How are you supposed to get to the person beneath all that makeup? I mean, I can't say that I wasn't warned. When I rang Roger Conover, the leading writer on Arthur Craven, he wasn't encouraging.
Everything seems beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But André Breton said that the ultimate way for an artist to conduct his life on the earth is to erase all of his footsteps behind him.
Okay.
Arthur Craven did that. Left no trace.
But you've written about him a bunch. How you go about like approaching a subject like that.
You like it. Never seen such an...
Roger? I think we've lost him. How are you supposed to get to the person beneath all that makeup?
Roger Lloyd Conover.
This problem becomes particularly important once we get to the story of Arthur Craven's final disappearance. A quick recap. Just before America joins World War I, Arthur Craven escapes military conscription by moving to Mexico, followed by his new wife, the poet Mina Loy.
I can provide for all your needs here.
After months of hunger and illness, they decide to buy a boat to sail from Mexico to Chile. Arthur Craven takes the boat out for a test sail and is never seen ever again. Maybe his boat sank. Maybe it was suicide. Maybe he abandoned his pregnant wife and made a run for it on his own.
I believe that I could marry you. I will be the happiest man in the world.
Tragically, all three endings have the potential to be true. And whatever ending we imagine radically changes how we view everything that happened in Arthur Craven's life right up to that moment. And that is why I think everybody reaches a point where they start trying to look behind that curtain, trying to find a clue to the real offstage Arthur Craven. That's the same problem I have. Without knowing the true face of Arthur Craven, I don't know where to start. I don't know if I'm making a program about the tragic accident of a groundbreaking, one-of-a-kind artist. Or is this a program about the tragedy of a boxer suffering from the onset of undiagnosed pugilistic dementia, reality becoming something impossible to hold on to? Or is this a program about an artist who joked about suicide in his art again and again, who then, when his artistic skills could no longer provide an escape, finally brought that joke across the line from fiction into reality? Or, worst of all, am I actually making a documentary series about an utterly irredeemable sociopath? A man for whom the titles of husband and father were just two more characters in his repertoire. Characters he could remove, sailing away from them with the same ease that he changed his personality on stage. What if I am halfway through making an art documentary praising the creative genius of a monster? What if the reason Rachel Hattles couldn't find evidence of a relatable behind-the-scenes version of Arthur Craven is because it doesn't exist? To continue my analogy from earlier, it would be like finally meeting Bela Lugosi and discovering that in real life he could turn into a bat and lived in a castle in Transylvania and killed people by drinking their blood. Before I went any further, I just needed some reassurances that there really was an artist hiding behind that curtain. I popped in to talk to my boxing coach again, the experimental poet Stephen Fowler.
I have definitely done performances where I wanted to give the appearance that I've lost control, and some of them have definitely become notorious. But I definitely planned them, and that's what Craven's about. Yeah, he's mad and he's aggressive. He knows what he's doing. It just seems like he did a really good job of covering up the offstage version.
Yeah, completely.
I think all the Dadaists and radical theatre makers of the 20th century were giving the appearance of being mad while not being mad at all. That's what Craven, I believe, was doing. And that's a kind of authenticity that we take for granted now. I mean, everyone does that now. Everyone positions themselves to appear the way that they want other people to perceive them. And he's doing that at the time.
So the Dadaists, just mentioned by Steve there, they were an art movement specifically interested in paradox, nonsense, anti-art. The whole strategy of the Dadaists was to confuse and confound. The Dada movement directly cited Craven as an inspiration. And I can see that in the way that Craven lived, how he hid his true intentions, told contradictory truths. Craven really does feel like a walking embodiment of these kinds of uncertainties. Steve also compared the exploits of Arthur Craven to the kinds of stories told in professional wrestling entertainment. In a pre-written wrestling narrative, things that look like mistakes get written into the story to help events feel more real. Let's apply this reading to a famous Arthur Craven anecdote. Shortly after arriving in New York from Spain, Craven was booked to give a lecture on futurism as part of the Society of Independent Artists exhibition. The story goes that the artist Marcel Duchamp, the guy who famously exhibited a urinal as art, took Craven out to lunch before the talk and got Craven so ridiculously drunk that Craven's lecture only lasted about a minute. He walked on stage to a packed room in front of the cream of New York society, immediately fell on his face, got up, started to take his trousers off, at which point he was wrestled to the ground by house detectives. I'd always thought of this story as a moment where Arthur Craven lost control of his stage persona. But then again, maybe this was exactly what he planned. After all, if he'd just given a lecture, no one would have ever spoken about that night ever again. But because he fell over and lost his trousers, that anecdote is a canonized part of the core Craven myth, endlessly repeated by his fans.
I mean, for a long time, I think when I first discovered poetry and art, I thought the Dadaists had kind of begun this process of ruining it for all of us because you can't shock people, but that's gone away. I mean, in the late 2000s, when I first got involved, I thought, oh my God, I can't do it because someone like Craven did it 100 years ago. But you could walk out now with a plastic gun or even a thong and people would be kind of horrified. Well, with me, they would definitely be horrified if I walked out in a thong. But I think it is pertinent that you're talking about Craven now. It really is, because that kind of deliberate, knowing and mindful provocation, which I believe it was, Dada isn't for nothing. It isn't indulgent. It isn't art for art's sake. This is the era of the First World War. This is the key piece of information for Dada. It was created in Zurich by people fleeing the First World War. It's a political protest. It's about the means of making art in a time of horror and death. Yeah. So he was trying to get at people for a real reason. Yeah. I think that's important quite now too. The more offended people get at simple things, the more we need to offend them, in my opinion.
I'm not the only person to mistake this artist for his wild public persona. As it turns out, many of Craven's peers in Paris made exactly the same mistake. The artist Gabriella Buffet-Bacabia said that Craven told her that he had been desperately unhappy in Paris because the art world took him for the brute he made himself out to be. In pretty much the same passage, Buffet-Bacabia says that she used to hide the jewellery whenever Craven came to visit, so it seems even she didn't fully trust Craven to separate himself from his brutish stage persona. Mistaking artists for the character they play on stage is a common enough occurrence, even today.
I mean, it's so over the top. It's the powder blue suit, it's a roll neck. In the early days, I think I would eat brie on stage. Like, it was just ridiculous. I'd soon drop that for various reasons, mainly health and being able to...
Alexis Dubis is a character performer. He's currently staging his 10th stand-up comedy show under the persona Marcel Lucan.
It's a louche Frenchman. It's the Frenchman that the British love to hate. I'm part French myself, so it sort of came from there, and he was just the antithesis of a good MC, a good compere. He did not care who was coming on next. There was this insouciance, there was just this lack of energy in the room. You know, I expect the audience to bring their own energy, that sort of thing, you know.
Marcel Lucan is implacable, he's superior. There's something about Marcel that feels really close to the spirit of Arthur Craven. Less shouty, maybe, but Marcel does treat his audience with a similar air of contempt. You might think that the success of Marcel Lucan as a comedic character relied on the audience knowing that he was a character, but it turns out that Marcel is mistaken for a real person.
Like, way more than you would think. I used to do the act and I'll come off stage, and if someone came up to me afterwards, I would drop instantly and I would say, oh, thanks, I'm glad you enjoyed the show. And their face would fall. I would see this disappointment, and I soon realised that people wanted to believe. There have been a few times, like, I've done castings where my agent has said, oh, they've asked specifically for you, thinking you're real. You have to go in, and it's with a French production company, and I've had to go in speaking French, do the audition in French, and leave speaking French.
Alexis said that improvising comedy on stage was so much easier as Marcel, because Marcel's personality was so much more contained. And I think this is why we all find personas so seductive. They're like real people, but with the crusts cut off. The choices they make are simpler, more predictable.
Like, how would you feel if, for whatever reason, many, many years from now, all record of you, Alexis, is destroyed, and the only thing that remains of your of knowledge of you is basically Marcel Lacan?
I would find that hilarious. I do not have the ego of Marcel, and I would happily jettison my ego for that to happen. I want him to be a real person. I think people want him to be a real person.
Arthur Craven's persona was off an audacious, brutish trickster. He was a persona so huge, so mythic, that the real person underneath the mask seemed to disappear completely. And who knows, this might well have been Craven's plan all along. The persona gets left behind while the guy behind the curtain slips away without a trace. The Escape Artist, Episode 6, The Persona, was written, presented and produced by me, Ross Sutherland. It was produced for the BBC by Melvin Rickaby. Additional voices were by Katie Bonner. The music was by Jeremy Wormsley.